Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we take a break from our regular program to bring you a special episode where we go into our archives to bring you stories around food. We begin with Azare Kiahi of Soulfire Farm, who talks with McKenna Connors about the importance of urmeb farming and Soulfire Farm's efforts towards greater food justice and food security. Then Anna Steltenkamp speaks with Chef Sean Sherman about his efforts to revitalize Native American cuisine. After that, Corinne Carey visits Justin Butts and his Cooney Cooney pigs on the farm. And finally, Mark Dunley interviews Mark Bittman about his recent book, Animal Vegetable Junk, The Evolution of the American Food Diet and the Need to Refocus the Food System. Food is inherently linked to the human experience, whether those experiences be about connecting with others or living with food insecurity. Urban farming and food justice initiatives such as Soulfire Farm are currently working in the capital region to remedy the harm done by unfair and unhealthy food systems. In this segment, you will hear Azare Kiahi of Soulfire Farm speaking with McKenna Connors.
Soulfire Farm is an Afro-Indigenous-centered community farm committed to uprooting racism and seeding sovereignty in the food system. And part of that is that we raise and distribute life-giving food as a means to end food apartheid. So we have an 80-acre farm in Grafton, New York, and we grow food on that farm, and we also share that food through a no-cost CSA program that we call Solidarity Shares in the capital region, so Albany, Troy, Schenectady. And we also host farm trainings in Grafton. We definitely used to have more programs on the farm, but in COVID times, we've also shifted a lot of our programming online so that we can reach more people. But overall, our goals rest in three areas, acknowledging that there's a need for transformation through justice, ecology, and healing. And part of this, too, is we host an online uprooting racism training that delves deep into the history and structural realities of racial injustice and help people develop an understanding of the movement strategies of frontline communities that are struggling for food sovereignty. So really, overall, our aim at Soulfire Farm is to provide access to life-giving food, both through programs like our No Cost CSA program, and also through allowing folks or teaching folks the skills they need to create their own gardens, not only through our farm immersion program, but also we have programs like Soulfire in the City, where folks can sign up to be taught how to set up their own raised bed gardens in the city and grow their own vegetables, and also to connect with one another, because what we realize is that a lot of the suffering that many of us go through is just from this disconnection between ourselves and sort of the ancestral ways that we used to know. And by sharing these skills with as many people as possible, we're able to nourish our hearts, minds, and bodies with this knowledge that was sort of stripped away from any of us.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So do you think urban farming efforts in general could have positive impact on communities that are living in food deserts?
I definitely do. I think urban farming can especially help shift the oppressive systems that prevent equal access to life-giving food. And I did want to point out, too, that the term that we prefer to use is over food desert, is food apartheid. Even though food desert definitely paints a clear picture of what we're up against, it sort of infers that food desert is a naturally occurring sort of reality, when really it's a system designed to oppress people within it. So, you know, urban farming allows us to sort of explore these skills of growing our own food. And for me, especially, I, you know, healthy food is obviously like gives life and nourishes our bodies. But I think a big part of it too, what helps communities is sort of your ability to like have agency over the food system, just with your participation in growing your own food, and even just like being outside and interacting with plants and interacting with neighbors. I think that beyond the food are those relationships that can really, you know, help fortify a community. And, you know, for me, like I live in Lansingburg and there's no grocery store within walking distance of my house. But by growing my own food or urban farming, I'm able to feed my family crops of my choice, including those that are more culturally appropriate and sometimes difficult to find in the grocery store. So I can, you know, grow whatever I want, but also I'm able to share my bounty with my neighbors, and also just the value of modeling what can happen in a small growing space, I think, is really important.
Definitely. Food has like such an important role in human culture and interaction that, you know, it's just incredibly important to both health and like physical and mental.
Definitely. You know, a lot of us are, I feel like we were raised to do the opposite, right? It's like we need to go to the grocery store and we need to, you know, rely on someone else as a way to sort of prove our self-worth, but we've all been conditioned to think these things, right? And so I think urban farming is just a nice way for us to explore what we're able to do.
What are your thoughts on how food and its accessibility, you know, can impact both individuals and communities?
This is a big question. I feel like I could talk about this all day, but what comes up for me in the context of food access in this way is like, I'm from Hawaii, and the last time I read, it was something like 90% of the food is imported to the island, and around 30% of agricultural land is owned by big seed companies like Monsanto. And so I can speak for how I was raised and my family's practices, that this reality, this lack of food access, not only prevented us from having access to nourishing food, but it also normalized our reliance on the bigger systems that were designed to oppress us. Mm-hmm. So my family is just one example, but, you know, because we had been separated from more culturally appropriate diet, many of my family members have diabetes, have heart disease, and all sorts of cancer. And so aside from making my people sick, I think the lack of food access has caused us to forget the ways of our ancestors, because we were conditioned to think that we must adapt to the colonizers' ways to survive and succeed. So for me, this is like much more than what ends up in our bellies. I think it's, you know, how we spend our time working at desks from 9 to 5 and shifting our values away from our basic needs of food, clothes, and shelter. Mm-hmm. I feel like that separating us from our food means that we've been separated from our culture and the power of our culture to help us survive as humans. And I imagine the same can be said for many folks, but that's like sort of, that's what that question brings up for me, is just thinking about like my roots and like where I've come from and how I've witnessed the impact of food access on my family. Yeah, and I know, like, for my grandma, like, I've always been, like, made fun of by my family. Like, oh, you like to grow your own food. It's almost like they think it's comical. Like I that means I can't, like, make the money to take care of myself, mm-hmm. right? But I think that it's been really enriching to sort of go back to my great-grandmother's ways and a really nice way to connect with family and neighbors. And I feel really grateful to have that experience.
Yeah, definitely. In what ways do you think things like food accessibility and urban farming, how do you think they can be promoted?
Yeah, well, I personally am a firm believer in just getting outside and being a spectacle and being kind and generous with your knowledge and share resources if you have them. I feel like the bulk of my so-called promotions of my growing practice are made when a passerby witnesses me harvesting or weeding and puttering out on the sidewalk. You know, it allows for spontaneous conversation. And it feels really, really important for me to build relationships and build the trust that it takes to encourage folks to explore things like urban farming and gardening and food as a way to connect. It seems like a really basic thing, right? But I do think it's really crucial, especially for those of us who have significant experience and been doing this for years, to remain humble and approachable so that all walks of life feel comfortable to ask questions and feel safe learning something new. I know, like, in my experience, you know, some folks are like, I want to come and garden with you, but I'm nervous. I don't know anything. And I think it's really, really important for those of us who, you know, have the skills, like, be super outspoken and outgoing with, like, what you know, and be approachable and make the information accessible to as many people as possible. That's what I think the most effective way we can promote urban farming or gardening is, to acknowledge that it's a way for us to learn together. It's a way for us to learn very basic survival skills together and to, you know, find solidarity in the shared need for food and our innate connection to the land and the power of our know-how and just the generosity of resources that are at our fingertips. And the more people we talk to, the more people we can be kind to and share with, the more people will be curious about learning how to grow their own food and have their own garden.
Yeah, awesome. So do you have any suggestions or tips for people attempting urban farming?
Depending on where you are, I definitely suggest getting in touch with your city government. I know, like, in Troy, I can speak for Troy, there's often quite a few vacant lots available. If you get in touch with the City of Troy Tax Assessor's Office, they typically put out a list so that you can get, you know, I think we bought a lot for $50. So very low cost land. I know when I left Hawaii, I never thought that I would actually own land. So land can be pretty accessible in the city. But with that said, if you are buying an urban plot, familiarize yourself with other gardeners in the community. There are a lot of other organizations that exist too. Probably, you know, I can speak for the Capital Region. There are places like the Radix Center, Soul Fire Farm, Capital Roots. I'm sure I'm forgetting others. There's a lot of resources. And so just, like, connecting with the folks in your community that have existing programs that can point you to more resources, just build those relationships so that you can scale up and make friends, share tips. And also, like, I always tell people, and it often feels like hard to say out loud because it doesn't feel like I'm saying much, but a lot of gardening and farming, I feel like, is just staying put and paying attention, observing what's happening, paying attention to what's working, what's not working, and acknowledging that, you know, learning takes time. And you're not going to learn overnight. And the moment that you stop learning is the moment that you should probably start learning again. So just being open-minded and being curious about the land and what you're capable of when you're caring for it.
That was Azaree Kiahi speaking with McKenna Connors. There are more stories around the theme Food Justice on our website, mediasanctuary.org. Chef Sean Sherman is the founder of the company The Sous Chef and the co-founder of the organization North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems. Sean speaks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Anna Steltenkamp about the importance of food for Native American identities, for the reclamation of Native American ancestral education, and for the well-being of both Native American communities and the environments wherein they reside.
My name is Sean Sherman. I am the CEO and founder of my company called The Sous Chef, spelled S-I-O-U-X, and also a founder of our nonprofit, which is natives.org, or North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems is the acronym, where we are opening up the Indigenous Food Lab this year.
Can you discuss the missions of your company, the Sous Chef, and your organization, North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, including what issues you are directly working to address?
Of course. The Sous Chef I created in 2014, and it came from quite a few years of researching and trying to understand Indigenous foods in general. I grew up on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota Sioux Tribe. And as a chef working in a city in Minneapolis, Minnesota, over time, or I should say, as I was working in restaurants in Minneapolis, Minnesota growing up in my 20s, I realized kind of the absence of Indigenous foods out there. And also realizing that after spending so much time in the restaurant world, that there was just so little representation of Indigenous culinary anywhere. I realized for myself that, you know, I could name off hundreds of European recipes off the top of my head and could only think of less than a dozen what would be true Lakota recipes that weren't fusionized with colonial ingredients. So it really set me on a path to understand, and the Sous Chef was really created to try and bring awareness to Indigenous foods. We did this through catering a lot around the Minneapolis area. We created a food truck called Tatanka Truck. Our methodology was utilizing regional Indigenous foods, cutting out colonial ingredients like dairy, wheat flour, cane sugar, beef, pork, chicken, prioritizing purchasing foods from Indigenous vendors where we could find them. So, for example, all of our wild rice, a lot of our lake fish like walleye and northerns were coming out of the Red Lake Reservation up north in Minnesota. We were buying maple. We were buying from three different native farms around the Minneapolis area. And we were just trying to purchase as much as we can. And we also released our cookbook, The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, which won the 2018 James Beard Award for Best American Cookbook. And we were really just trying to utilize this book as also to raise awareness with this knowledge and this education. So early on within the Sous Chef, we realized the vast need for this knowledge and education out there all across the board. So we live in this world today where you can find food capitals of the U.S. like Chicago, L.A., Manhattan, where we still have today zero Native American restaurants that represent the land that they're standing on or run by the Indigenous peoples of those regions. So we created a system to try and help create more Indigenous food businesses by really centering our nonprofit around Indigenous education and creating Indigenous food access. Through our nonprofit Natives, we are opening up Indigenous Food Lab with the mindset of creating a focused Indigenous production kitchen with a classroom so we can teach about Indigenous curriculum and have a research and development center where we can create a lot of Indigenous curriculum and creating a space where people can come and learn and work with us and build skills around Indigenous foods. Our goal with this production and training and educational kitchen is to work directly with tribal communities, helping them to develop their own Indigenous kitchen to create at least one access point of healthy Indigenous food within those tribal communities. And where we would help them develop each food entity to be unique to that tribe with their language and their culture and history in mind and the foods around them, and hopefully help them to develop more community gardens utilizing Indigenous seeds, utilizing permaculture design and placing foods all around them, and just making an outlet for people to come to understand more about their traditional food ways and how we can apply that to today's world and this modern world. Our goal is to eventually replicate this system of having a training educational system within a city and the satellites of tribal communities in creating small food production and units around those and moving this all over the nation so we could be opening in cities everywhere, whether it's Charleston or Seattle or Albuquerque or Santa Fe or San Francisco or Boston or Chicago. Each regional Indigenous food lab would create that epicenter to help support, develop, train, and educate about Indigenous foods to those regions And hopefully we can see more and more Indigenous food production businesses happening all across the nation. We have a vision and goal in mind to help create these Indigenous food places. So one day you'd be able to drive across North America, stopping at all this unique and diverse Indigenous food businesses and experience all this cultural and culinary diversity that we have sitting everywhere.
Can you expand upon the importance of revitalizing Native American culture, specifically looking at how establishing a Native American cuisine and access within Native American communities can help address some of the health and economic issues that are present within these communities?
You know, from my own experience growing up on Pine Ridge Reservation, which has been the poorest community in the United States ever since its inception, you know, there's a lot of issues when it comes to food insecurity and being over-reliant on government-issued foods. I myself grew up with the Commodity Food Program, and if we look at what the Commodity Food Program has done, we have, you know, a few decades of really strong information to showcase, you know, what happens to an entire community when their sole form of nutrition is coming from a program much like the commodity food system, you know, which offers us very little nutrition, foods that are not even close to being within our traditional diets. And all the health issues that are coming out of that, like type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart disease, you name it. So all this foodborne illness coming directly from these government subsidies. So we want to really help and showcase how amazing it would be if we were able to revitalize and reintroduce Indigenous foodways back into tribal communities by helping people find the tools they need to grow out community gardens to regain the knowledge that they would have of wild foods and plants of their region and how to preserve, process, how to harvest sustainably, and how to help the environment to continue to grow all of this food and medicine, and strengthen these cultures by helping them to develop, you know, stronger and more cultural relevant ties to the environment around them, and really respect the lessons that their ancestors had intended them to have. I think with COVID crisis that's happening to us all right now, it really showcased how dangerous it is to be over-reliant on government subsidies and over-processed foods. And we really need to get back to a healthier, cleaner diet. Indigenous diets in general are low glycemic. They are high in good oils and fats. There's an immense amount of plant diversity. There's really healthy proteins. And it's just an ideal diet in general. And we could really see a lot of impact if we're able to build these in real time. And part of this work for us is making sure that we have kitchens that are devoted and dedicated to processing and sharing a lot of these Indigenous foods for our organization to help these communities develop more and more healthy Indigenous-focused diet recipes to really impact those communities and bring a sense of pride to the cultural foods and the diversity that sits out there.
Can you expand upon the specific Native traditions and Indigenous foods that define Native American cuisine, perhaps giving a couple examples of important foods or plants that you especially utilize as a chef?
I think the most important thing to understand when you're looking at Native American foods is that you can't lump sum it all into one group or category because there's still so much diversity out there. With 573 tribes across the U.S., 222 of those tribes are all in Alaska, 622 tribes in Canada, and 20% of Mexico identifying as Indigenous, and almost 8% of their population speaking Indigenous languages over Spanish still today. So part of that understanding is just realizing how much regional and cultural diversity sits across the board when you look at, you know, a non-colonial and Indigenous perspective of North America, and to really think about, you know, what is special and unique to every single region, no matter where you are, whether you're on the East Coast or the Pacific Northwest or way up in northern Canada or deep down into southern Mexico. There's just so much diversity out there. So you look at the commonalities that Indigenous peoples utilize for food systems, which is what we did to kind of map out what is an Indigenous food system. So it's a deep understanding of if they had agriculture, what kind of seeds were they utilizing, and are those seeds still available today? So looking at the diversity of corns and beans and squash and sunflower and chilies, and just understanding like how much diversity and how people were processing those foods, and how the different farming techniques and styles people were utilizing, the really vast knowledge of ethnobotanicals and how people were utilizing plants of their regions. it's just an amazing, education to think about, because it really puts us directly in touch with nature around us and showcases us how much underutilized plant life is around us that the Western diet has never touched, and that how we can really adapt to truly organic systems and permacultural systems of utilizing land space to grow out and to help harbor a lot more food and medicine. So you can take any area particularly and just look at any region, and it's going to be exciting to learn about what makes that area unique and the recipes that you can build around that. So for my area where I grew up in South Dakota, the Lakota, we were utilizing a lot of game meat. So there was a lot of elk, there's a lot of bison, venison, rabbit, you name it. Like, we feel like protein is kind of the easiest piece, because basically anything moving out there can be literally game. And for us, removing beef, pork, and chicken, which were not natural to these regions and were not even introduced into those regions until much later. But also looking at how my tribe was utilizing a lot of farmed goods from some of the farming tribes around the Dakotas. So being able to have access to corns and beans and squash and sunflower seeds. And also looking at the vast knowledge of indigenous ethnobotanical studies and understanding that every plant out there has very specific uses for food, for medicine, for crafting, and for everything, for shelter, for clothing, you name it. So for me growing up with harvesting chokecherries or harvesting timsila, which is a wild prairie turnip, are things that are very unique to my region. It's just a lot of fun to explore like all of these botanicals that lie across the board.
You can hear the full interview with Chef Sean Sherman on our website at mediasanctuary.org. Typing Indigenous Voices into the search field will lead you to Anna Stelton Camp's complete series of interviews for Indigenous Voices at the Intersection of Environmental and Social Justice. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or feedback, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Justin Butts is a local farmer and livestock manager raising pigs, making soap, and working at Laughing Earth Farm in Cropseyville, New York. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey visited Justin and his Kune Kune pigs on the farm to talk about his career, soap making, and humane and sustainable agriculture.
Justin, thank you so much for taking a few moments to talk to me today.
It's a pleasure, Corinne. Thank you.
Can you tell me how you got your start being a livestock manager?
Well, I started farming about 7 years ago, right after I got out of the Navy. I went to the seed farm in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. That was a year-long farm apprenticeship, and I learned organic vegetable farming there. And while I did that, I also took over someone else's farm, and I had 500 chickens on my own personal farm, and then I bought four pigs that year as part of that farm. And I ended up not keeping that original farm. I had a lease for it, and I ended up not leasing it the second year. But I kept the pigs all through college. Throughout the years I was in college, my herd of pigs got bigger, and I started my soap company, where I started making my own lard soap out of the pigs. I worked at a few livestock jobs when I was younger. I used to work at like a tack shop, so I was around horses. And I had some farming experience. I used that plus my time at culinary school, having experience actually cooking the animals and having knowledge of what the next step is after they're on the farm. I used that to transition into a livestock management position at Soulfire Farm. And I was the livestock manager there for a year. And now I'm the livestock manager here at Laughing Earth Farm. But I had my own livestock, so that was what I really feel like gave me the experience to work for somebody else and take care of their livestock.
So you said you mentioned you started some of this work while you were in college. Where did you go to college?
I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. I started in 2016 and I graduated in 2019 with a bachelor's and business administration with a concentration in farm-to-table cooking. Yeah, I've really enjoyed my time there. I'd wanted to go there since I was, like, younger. And that was part of why I actually joined the Navy, was to pay for culinary school.
You took a bit of a different turn in culinary school. Most people go and cook somewhere. You started to make your own soap. Can you talk a little bit about how you started to do that? What was your motivation and how that went while you were in college?
Well, I've always had a passion for making, like, value-added products. I think that's really where the money is with farming, like making something out of the things that you grow rather than just producing like a raw product. You actually process it into something like salsa or tomato sauce, or with the pigs, I make bacon and pork products for myself, and then I take all the lard and I turn the lard into soap. I started doing that because I couldn't get my pigs to a butcher. When I was in college, I had a vehicle, but I couldn't put the pigs in it, and I also couldn't get a date. I was having a hard time getting my pigs to the slaughterhouse. So I did some research, and I realized that I did not have to have inspections to take it to a slaughterhouse if I was only using the lard to make soap, because I'm not making a food product, I'm making a soap product as a cosmetic. So I was able to do that and still be able to sell my pigs. I could process my own pigs without having to pay anyone to do it. And that was kind of what pushed me toward the soap. And then soap is shelf stable. It doesn't go bad. So it actually gets better over time. So that was kind of one of the reasons soap was very appealing to me.
And your soaps are food scented. Can you talk about what kind of different soaps you make?
Most of my soaps are actually food inspired. A lot of the times when I'm making soap, it looks like I'm about to like bake a cake or something like that. One of my favorites is the orange carrot vanilla that I make, and it has carrot juice and orange zest and some vanilla in it. And then I make key lime mojito soap. I do chocolate stout soap. I've done some like red wine and eucalyptus before. I've done a lot of different flavors with foods. And sometimes I'll just make one that I'm like inspired by at the time. Like I've been working on like a grapefruit coconut, but I haven't got it to the point where I think it's ready to start selling to people. But I just try to make up new flavors here and there.
And where can people buy your soap?
Well, I sell it here at Laughing Earth Farm. They have it in their farm stand. And then I have a website. It's Butts Brothers Handmade Lard Soap. And typically the website is up and I have bars of soap available on there.
How many pigs do you have now? I mean, we're sitting, as I'm talking to you, we're sitting in a field. It just started to rain, and we've got pigs all around us. How many do you have?
Well, this field has 12 in it, and then I have another 12 pigs over in the other field. And I also have a flock of 15 sheep. So I have 24 pigs altogether and about 15 sheep.
These are special pigs. What kind of pigs are they?
These are Cooney pigs. They were actually a rare and endangered breed when I got them. They're a breed of miniature pig from New Zealand. A big Koni Koni only gets to be about 300 pounds, and they produce a thick layer of lard under their skin. But because they're from this environment, they're very prolific. They're very easy on the soil. They have upturned snouts, so they like to graze the pastures rather than making a lot of holes, as other pigs might. And they eat a lot more hay, so I can save on buying pig food that way. And there's the most docile breed of pig that is available. That I have found. So these ones are more, I don't like to call them pets, but these pigs you can walk up to and sit down and pet them and, you know, enjoy spending time with them, as opposed to some of the other pigs here on the farm. They're a little more, they have a little more energy because they're meant to be a little more rugged and they grow a little faster. So these are piglets for about a year almost, it seems like. They stay very small and very, very cute. And even when they are big, they're just the size of large dogs. So they're very easy to handle. If you're new to farming, you can still grab one of these pigs and, you know, take it somewhere if you needed to.
In addition to the pigs that you keep, you said sheep, and you also keep bees. Can you talk about those other aspects?
Oh yes, well, the sheep I keep are grass-fed sheep. I keep them mainly for meat and just also to help mow. Mowing the lawn uses gas and petroleum, and I think just being on the farm is a way to keep some of the fields nicely mowed without having to come out and mow and be so destructive. And because mowing also destroys habitat for like ground birds and things like that. So the sheep are a little easier on the farm. And then you're producing meat while keeping the field nice. And then I started keeping the bees because I like to cook and bake a lot. And also I put honey in every bar of soap that I make. So I wanted a way to produce my own honey so I could have a better bar of soap. It's really my goal just to have the best possible soap. So eventually I would like to get some milk goats and maybe even a few other animals just to really make a very restorative an enjoyable bar of soap. Just something, I think when you shower, it should be like a nice experience and it should help you relax. And I definitely feel like mine helps my skin just relax and heal after a long day out on the farm.
Well, I can attest. I love the Mojito Lime soap that you make.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's one of my favorites.
It sounds like in everything that you do that you're really committed to sustainable agriculture. Can you tell me why? Where did that come from?
I think self-sufficiency and just being able to produce as much on your own is a very important skill to have. I think we're very dependent on other people to do things for us. And by making my own soap or producing my own meat, I'm less dependent on others for things. And I like that. I like having skills and just being able to take care of myself and my family. So the more I can do on my own, that's kind of what inspires me to learn new skills.
What about the way that Laughing Earth runs their farm appeals to you?
Well, Laughing Earth is mainly a pasture-based operation. It's an organic operation primarily. Well, the way they keep their animals, they're outside. They're not confined all the time. They're in the sunlight. There's just a lot of care given to them. And then the soil is looked after. They're not put on the same piece of land for a super extended period of time. They're rotated. And, they're constantly reseeding pastures and just looking after their land. So that's what's appealing to me, just people that want to steward their land and take care of it and work with nature rather than trying to kind of just control it. They're trying to make the land the best it can be.
What's your biggest challenge in the work that you do right now?
I would say finding enough time and energy to complete all of the tasks I need to do in a day. I look at my pedometer sometimes on my phone, and on a day here on the farm, I might walk like 11 miles sometimes, just setting up fences for new pens and moving animals around and looking after different things. So just having enough time to make sure everything is done as best as it can be done, because there's no point to doing it and just putting half your energy into it. You really want to do a good job if you're taking the animals on, because they didn't ask to be here. They're your responsibility. They need you to look out for them. So that's kind of motivates me to do a good job with the animals. Maybe a nice sheepdog would be helpful too.
The last time I was here, we talked about how in order to really, truly appreciate a good meal of pork, it's important to understand how the animal is slaughtered. Can you talk about that for a bit and how important that is to you?
Well, I just think there's a big detachment between understanding that every time we eat meat, something had to give a sacrifice for that to happen. It's very easy to be wasteful, and just if you have something you bought from the store, to kind of throw it out at the end of the day if you don't cook it because you didn't play a part in it. But, you know, when we eat meat, they're actually living animals. We're part of a natural system of life that's been going on for thousands of years, and you kind of want to honor that and make sure the animals live a good life. So I'd rather eat from animals that are living an enjoyable life, like my pigs here, wagging their tails and just in nature, than something that's confined inside.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you for coming out.
Justin Butts spoke with Corinne Carey, and you can find Butts Bros Handmade Lard Soap at Laughing Earth Farms stand or find at Butts Bros Handmade Lard Soap on Facebook. Mark Bittman has been writing about food since the early 80s and is currently special advisor on food policy at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, where he teaches and hosts a lecture series called Food, Public Health, and Social Justice. Mark Dunley spoke with Mark Bittman about his writing and about relating food to issues in the world.
We're honored today to be joined by Mark Bittman, a well-known food writer, author, and former New York Times columnist. And we're going to be talking about his latest book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable Suicidal, which traces humankind's never-ending quest for nutrition from leaves, roots, and carrion to agri-corporations and processed pseudo food. So, Mark, why don't we start off? What prompted you to write this particular book?
Well, I've been writing about food policy, food issues for 15 years or so. And the last five of those, I'd had a weekly opinion column in the Times. My goal with the opinion column was to tackle one issue in food at a time. I thought there were 50 or so major pieces to write or important pieces to write about food. And I thought I'd do them sequentially. And when I finished, I'd see what happened. Well, I wound up writing probably 200 columns. Some were repetitive. Others were about issues that I hadn't considered at the beginning. Some were straight news pieces in the guise of opinion stories. But when I reflected 4.5 years later, I realized that I really had handled things piecemeal. And while that was an interesting way to do things, it wasn't a way that showed people the whole picture. They were getting to see a little bit of it at a time, but there was no single place that I could say, here's what I think about food, here's how we got here, here's where we're at, here's where we might go. So I decided to write what became Animal Vegetable Junk, and that took 4 or 5 years from conception to finish.
Now, one of the points you make is that humans have always appreciated good food and good flavors. We are hotwired to eat sugar and salt and fat. And that unfortunately seems to have led us down to the road of junk food that is not apparently very healthy for our diets.
Well, if there's a question in there, I guess it's how we got. I mean, all of those things are true. We are hardwired. We're hardwired to consume calories. We're hardwired to like sugar and fat. They're important. They're in foods that are important to us. But we, our hardwiring never took into account a superabundance of food. It never took into account marketing of things that hit our hot buttons that weren't good for us. Never took into account marketing at all. So as it became easier and easier to industrialize food, to mass produce food, as it became easier and easier to extract some of the nutrients, some of the ingredients of food and create new foods with them. And most of this happened in the early 20th century, but it accelerated through the 20th century. It happened that an entire group of foods that is not natural, that doesn't, in the sense that it does not exist in nature, began to be marketed to us as if they were the equivalents of real foods. And we began to be presented with things like breakfast cereal, soda, candy, ice cream in unlimited quantities, foods that are fine in very limited quantities, but again, which did not exist in nature and which are not fine in unlimited amounts consumed as our brain would have us consume them, which is to say, as many as possible. And engineers, marketing whizzes, psychologists all teamed together to produce food that hit more and more of those hot spots in our brain and made it more and more difficult for many of us to stop eating those foods. And the result has been a number of metabolic problems, which seem to have led to a number of chronic diseases, which in turn has shortened our lifespan and made diet-related chronic disease the number one killer in the United States.
One of the points that you make in the book is one that I've been making for quite a while, though perhaps at a little bit different perspective, and that is how our present food system is actually one of the great contributors to the dramatic rise in cancer in the United States. I've always approached it particularly as we've added more and more chemicals to our food system that obviously we did ingest, can contribute to the rise of cancer. But how would you see the cancer coming out of our food system?
You know, I think it's a little overly simplistic to blame the food system for the rise in cancers, because there are literally countless, tens of thousands of chemicals in the environment that weren't there 100 years ago. So yes, many, many of them are a part of raising food industrially, and food system and pesticides and chemicals used in food and in food packaging are part of the issue here. But cosmetics, cleaning materials, building supplies, on and on and on, all contain chemicals that didn't exist 100 years ago, many even 50 years ago, and there is no regulatory agency doing its job to say which of these cancers threatens our health. I mean, which of these chemicals threatens our health and which of them does not. So having said that, I said the food system is a major culprit in that, and it is. The answer to this is to make food without chemicals. It's to farm with as few chemicals as possible to reduce the ultra processing of food. 60% of the calories we get now are worthless calories in the form, even harmful calories in the form of ultra processed foods. The way to do this is to find a way for us to feed ourselves that isn't damaging. Chemicals are certainly a part of that.
Now, several reviews I've read of the book particularly focus on this one particular point you make, and that is that the tragic result of the push to standardize monoculture was that scientists and researchers became allied not with farmers, but with bankers, equipment manufacturers, and seller of seeds and chemicals. How do we reverse that process?
Well, that's what we used to call the $64,000 question. That is the question that's at the key, at the heart of all of this. And it is not just a food question, because we could ask that question about democracy in general. How do we get to a point where systems are run, the systems that affect all of us in society, are run for our mutual benefit and not primarily for profit? Now, that is a valid and pressing question in food, but it's a valid and pressing question in many aspects of the economy, including housing, the environment, transportation, healthcare, on and on and on, almost anything you could name. So the answer to that is really democracy and justice. How do we improve our participation in democracy? How do we regain power on the collective neighborhood and local and regional level? How do we exercise that power nationally? And the answer to that is quite simply organizing and collective effort, rather than allowing ourselves to be atomized and having what amounts to an oligarchy running our society. So that is a food question, but it goes beyond food as well.
We've been talking with Mark Bittman about his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Now, one of the individuals actually has a connection to the Capital District. He went to law school at Albany Law School, is Tom Vilsack, who is the head of the Department of Agriculture. And I know one of the big issues I used to work on when I ran the Hunger Action Network for many years was the Farm Bill, which is, you know, sort of the blueprint of how we, you know, sort of oversee and direct the food system in the United States. Does Mr. Vilsack, you know, grasp the problems that are being created by our, you know, corporate food system, or is he tends to be a little bit of a cheerleader for them?
I don't know what goes on in Mr. Vilsack's mind. In the early days of the Biden administration, the very, very early days, there were some indications that he was beginning to understand the scope of the problems in food, which run from inequality to environmental damage to the public health crisis we talked about in the earlier segment and so on. But he very quickly reverted to his original self, which has been as a booster of corporate industrial agriculture. And his attitude is, if people buy different food, then agriculture will be forced to change. But it's supply that's determining demand in this case, not the other way around. And it seems determined to have as little impact on industrial agriculture as he can, to support it as far as he can.
What are some of the steps that you think, you know, for instance, Congress should be taking at this point, you know, to try to, you know, reorient our agriculture system? And you, in fact, point out that, you know, we may be at the point where there needs to be actual government policies to restrict access to junk food you know, there have been several proposals like Mayor Bloomberg in New York City to restrict access to soda, but particularly only for, you know, food stamp recipients, not allowing them to buy junk food. Doesn't seem like they've really been willing to push that across the entire, you know, American marketplace and consumers.
Well, New York did pass a soda tax, which was struck down by a judge. So they were willing. The judge wasn't willing. Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, Philadelphia, I think Cook County, Illinois, a number of other jurisdictions in the United States have soda taxes now, and they do seem to make a difference. I think we have to experiment with a number of different measures that will encourage people to eat better food and disencourage us from eating food that's harmful. Certainly increased access to fruits and vegetables would make a huge difference. There are a couple of things that could be done almost immediately that every administration from Obama through Trump into Biden has refused to do. High among them, although not the biggest problem in food, but among the easiest to solve, is the presence of antibiotics in the food supply. 80% of all antibiotics are administered to animals in factory farms, and those antibiotics affect our water supply, affect our land, our soil, that is, and affect our health, because increased exposure to antibiotics in animals breeds resistance in those bacteria, and those bacteria, which are then, in some cases, infect humans, are then immune to the antibiotics that previously were able to treat them. And as a result, some number unknown of Americans in the tens of thousands die every year from infections that could have been treated by antibiotics previously. Antibiotics in the animal supply also make factory farming possible, because the routine use of antibiotics makes it possible to crowd animals in unimaginably horrible conditions. Now, antibiotic use in animal feed is regulated by FDA, and FDA could make that illegal, could prohibit that by edict, and they could do that overnight. And they could have done that the first day of the Obama administration. They considered it and refused to do it. They made use of antibiotics voluntary, and no one has acted on it ever since. As I say, that's not the biggest issue in the food system, but it is a big issue, and it's an issue that could be resolved right away, and yet we can't get government to pay any attention to it at all. Back to your question about Mr. Vilsack, there's no indication that he said to FDA this would be a good idea. There's no indication that anyone in the Biden administration believes this would be a good idea, and yet it's an important measure, and it's a measure that really should happen sooner rather than later.
One of the points you make in the book is that every issue touches another, and particularly you really can't talk about food changes without also talking about the welfare of food workers, and you can't talk about food workers without talking about income inequality, you know, racism and immigration. How do you see that, you know, sort of playing out, trying to connect all the different issues together?
It's a question of considering what food is and what food is for. If you think food is to go have fun in restaurants and to eat whatever you want and to buy whatever you want, that's a short-sighted view. If you think what actually comprises food, how's it made, where's it come from, what goes into it, how does it get to you, you quickly realize that there are lots and lots of issues associated with food, from carbon footprint to migrant labor, to the server in a restaurant, to the person working in a fast food restaurant, to the trucker who's bringing food from one side of the country to another, to the supermarket clerk or shelf stocker, and so on and so on and so on. And each of those people that I just named is, generally speaking, exploited. They're a minimum wage worker. They could even be a sub-minimum wage worker, because restaurant workers' pay is often based on tips, which leads to even greater exploitation. The fact that food access is more limited in some neighborhoods than others. Of course, the fact that poor people can't really afford to eat better because we've got a system that's made ultra-processed food, cheap calories, useless calories or harmful calories in many cases, the most inexpensive, and the best food, the most expensive food. So once you start thinking along those lines, you see that food is at the hub of many, many issues. And there are, you know, you could make a similar case for inequality as the hub of many issues, housing as the hub of many issues, race as the hub of many issues, gender inequality, and so on. But food is a very good example of something that sits at the nexus of just about everything else and makes it so clear that to make food good, that is to make food that has a lower impact on the environment, that's widely available to many people, that's nutritious, that's farmed and served in a way that, that treats its workers responsibly. To make food good that way, you have to make society just and fair. And that's actually why I like talking about food, because you can raise almost any issue you want to and tie it back to food, not in a contrived way, but in a wholly legitimate way.
You only have about maybe 90 seconds left. Why don't you talk a little bit about BittmanProject.com?
Well, after writing Animal Vegetable Junk, I realized that I had an unusual, if not unique, position in the food world in this country. And that is, I can talk about everything from cooking, you probably know I've written a bunch of cookbooks, to the things we've been talking about. And so I thought a stab at independent journalism would be an interesting thing to tackle. So we've got a newsletter at BittmanProject.com. We have a newsletter and a podcast. And we are trying to cover the entire range of food issues, from what to cook for dinner tonight to how food affects income inequality, or how you could go about finding or supporting better food in your...
We've been talking with Mark Bittman, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal.
MarkBittman.com or BittmanProject.com.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Mark Bittman has written 30 books, New York Times columns, and has a podcast and many videos. You can learn more at markbittman.com. That concludes our show. You can find more stories around cooking, farming, and food justice on our website. We hope you've enjoyed this special episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. This program's content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all of the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.